It was pitch black, and I rolled down to the water, and it was huge. I couldn't tell how deep it was in the dark, but I, even with my really bright light, I could barely see the other bank on the other side. And it was deep, as it turned out. It was over my waist, and I carried my bike overhead. And then I got to the other side, and it was just this thick tangle of like driftwood and flotsam from the flooding. And I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly what tiger snakes love to hang out in. That was absolutely one of the hardest moments mentally.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo.
Yeah.
This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's rug.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show, and welcome to another Q&A episode. It's been quite a while since we did one of these, but with so many questions flooding in over social media and via email and all that sort of thing in the last couple of weeks after the big Tasmanian crossing ride, it felt like a great time to do another one of these. For those that are not familiar, these are just me talking into the mic. There is no guest for these. They're a little bit unusual, but now and then we slot one in, and it's really enjoyable to get to kind of interact directly with the listeners and answer some of your questions directly. This one has a lot. I got to as many as I could. It certainly wasn't all of them, but I think there's lots of good stuff in here that y'all will enjoy if you have enjoyed following the Crossing Tasmania ride. I am recording this intro from the North Island of New Zealand. We arrived yesterday. Our Southern Hemisphere tour is rolling on. Very grudgingly, we finally bid adieu to Tasmania, but I know we'll be back there again very soon. That said, we're really excited to check out what New Zealand is about. It's pretty funny. Plenty of people have told us that the only place in the world better than Tasmania is New Zealand, so we have pretty high expectations. Nicole and I are going to be doing some pretty fun backcountry riding. We actually put together a little multi-day route. We've toted along a bunch of bikepacking gear for this trip, and we're finally going to put it to use, and we'll be producing some storytelling to go along with that adventure as we do it. Might even do some kind of mini podcast episodes like we did for Iceland last year, sort of like daily dispatches. We'll see how that comes together. So stay tuned for that. I want to say a big thank you today to Dometic for supporting today's episode and supporting the Crossing Tasmania project. We actually relied very heavily on their CFX3 95 liter cooler, which is the largest powered cooler that they make. And the reason that we relied on it so heavily is that when we headed out to Arthur River and the start of my route, that northwestern quadrant of Tasmania is mostly uninhabited, mostly wilderness, with very few amenities, almost no stores. And that meant that we had to be really self-reliant and self-sufficient. And so we loaded up our Dometic CFX 95 liter cooler with enough food and drinks to sustain a crew of 8 people for the couple of days while we got our feet under us at that start point of the route. And we were so grateful to have this cooler. Also really helpful that it has flexible power sources. We powered it off of a solar panel one afternoon. Also, the super powerful and efficient PLB lithium ion battery from Dometic. These coolers are super efficient. We're able to keep all of our food, etc., cold for those few days. And yeah, like I said, I'm not sure what we would have done without it. If you'd like to go check out Dometic's CFX line of powered coolers, you can go to dometic.com/outdoor. I know they're running a pretty crazy sale right now across the board, and I believe some of those coolers are marked down as well. You can get a further discount, I believe, or maybe just a deeper discount by using code STASH15 at checkout. That's all caps STASH15 stache15@dometic.com/outdoor. Thank y'all so much for listening today, and we will catch you after the show. First off, thanks everyone that submitted questions. Obviously, without questions, there would be no Q&A episode, so thanks to everyone that sent them in via DM, email, answered the question sticker on the story I put out, etc. I certainly won't be able to get to all of them, but I'm going to get to as many of the best ones as I can. For the first time, I've sort of categorized them a little bit and jotted down a few notes beforehand. First sort of topic of questions that I've clustered together are gear related, and then we'll kind of move into what the route was, why, how we arrived at the route, some background on Tassie, all that sort of thing, how the project came about. And then we'll move into a bunch of questions that seem directed towards the ride itself, how it went, how it unfolded, different experiences I had, all that sort of thing. And then lastly, we'll kind of move into questions that are bigger picture, some post-ride thoughts, sort of the after section, you could say. So kicking things off with some gear-related things here. First question was, what aero bars are you running, and do you have any spacers? Cheers. Love your work. I ran the Zip VUCA Evo aero bars, which is what I also used in Iceland, but this go-around, while I was still in Bentonville, shortly before leaving for Tassie, I had SRAM install some ETAP clicks on the ends of the aero bars, which are these really cool little shifters, kind of like blip buttons that work in conjunction with the axis shifters and drivetrain system. So basically I had a typical shifter on the handlebar as you would on a mountain bike, and then also shifters on the ends of my aero bars, which allowed me to shift obviously while I was in the aero bars, which sounds like a minor thing, but it was huge. It allowed me to stay in the aero bars way more than I would have otherwise. This route was super, super diverse. So there were long periods of time when I was in the aero bars and then many hours at a time where I couldn't be in the aero bars. But this definitely was really nice when I was getting tired and just having the option so I wasn't constantly shifting positions when I needed to shift was huge. In terms of spacers, I just had a spacer underneath the stem, one spacer. Usually I run the stem slammed, but for something this long, I figured it'd be nice to have a slightly more upright position, both when in the aero bars, but also just when resting on the top of the flat bars on the mountain bike bars, just from a slightly more comfortable standpoint. That said, it's amazing how much faster tucking down into the aero bars was, which was nice. And I'll get into why this wasn't a totally, you know, cutthroat speed mission. In fact, I really shied away from calling it an FKT. In a lot of ways, it was sort of an anti-FKT, and I'll get into that. But even so, it's just really fun to ride fast. And I also had no idea how long this was going to take. And so doing it as quickly as I could both sounded fun and then also just seemed practical. You know, if you lollygag your way through 360 miles, who knows how long it's going to take. Love to hear your thoughts and experience on tire choice, pressure, etc. I ran the Maxxis Aspen with an XO casing, which is a reinforced casing, in 2.4 width. And there's going to be some more information coming out about these tires soon. They weren't just any old Aspens. More on that in the new year. But tire pressure wise, I was running 20 PSI front and rear, which was perfect, actually. No complaints there. No inserts, just set up tubeless as is, you know, pretty typical tubeless setup. 3-ish ounces of Orange Seal in both front and rear tires. Nice wide rim internal. So that 2.4 probably actually measured out even a little wider. Tire choice was kind of tricky. This route, and I'll kind of roll up the sleeves and give a background on this route later, but there was over 100 miles of pavement, believe it or not, but also well over 100 miles of single track and pretty well abandoned backcountry track / goat trails, much of which wasn't even rideable, some of which was barely rideable. So I needed a bike that could do some of everything. So tire choice was really kind of tricky in terms of splitting the difference. What would roll fast on pavement, but then also handle well on some really heinous mountain biking terrain? And that 2.4 Aspen, in hindsight, was perfect. I wouldn't have changed anything in that regard. What lights did you run? I ran the Ledlinzer H19R, which is the light that I used in Iceland also. This is a really awesome high-powered light out of from a company out of Germany. Big shout out to Ivan at Red Bull for making that connection. He's friends with some folks over there, and they're super bright. I ran two of them. This was kind of funny for anyone that hasn't heard last week's conversation with Emma. First of all, I would highly recommend you go back and listen to it. But also, there's a funny moment in that conversation when I say, so I was planning to just run a handlebar light and leave the headlamp at home. And she was like, no way. You got to run a headlight too, if for no other reason than all the wildlife that you're going to be dodging. So I took two and they were awesome. Absolutely love those lights. What brand and model vest? Same vest, believe it or not, that I use for racing gravel. It's the Osprey Duro 1.5, and it's a really nice, felt, tight-fitting vest. I think technically it's kind of designed for ultra running and trail running, but many cyclists have adopted it over the last handful of years. And although it has really low profile and looks low capacity, it carries a 1.5 liter reservoir. But it actually has a surprising amount of storage, and I really tested the limits of this on my crossing. It has the main compartment, which is predominantly taken up by the reservoir, but it's also got these mesh pockets kind of on the front and then a couple on the sides. And if you don't know they're there or you don't look closely, you might even not see them when they're empty, but they're mesh, and so you can really actually stuff them and they'll expand. And so I had all kinds of stuff in them throughout the ride, from leg warmers and arm warmers and a buff to a vest to like chain lube and CO2s and food. And when you really stuff this vest to full capacity, it's pretty amazing how much you can get into it. So I was really happy with the capacity there. Did you ever swap Axis batteries? Yes, absolutely. And this was actually kind of a funny thing. So I pre-rode a few of the sections of this route in the days beforehand, just kind of scouting, making sure I was happy with equipment choice, getting a bit of shooting in, all that sort of thing. And it quickly dawned on me how much climbing there was on this route. And that sounds dumb, because when you look at the course profile, it's very jagged, and you can see the estimated total elevation gain, which I think was 31,000 feet of climbing. That was the estimate. But sort of, I think what I looked past early on is that at about mile like 200 to 250, it's almost dead flat. The long, very smooth, flat section of pavement. And to get 31,000 feet of climbing when you account for a section in the middle that's so flat, that means the remaining 290, 300 miles is going to have to be really, really climby. And it was. And so the more I poked around on this route in the days beforehand, the more I realized just how demanding the climb was going to be. And the other thing I noticed is Tasmania doesn't really have switchbacks. I don't think I saw a switchback the whole time I was there, except for maybe the trails in Derby. A lot of these roads were put in by mining operations and forestry operations. And so, you know, they were utilizing, or they were using heavy equipment a lot of times, transporting heavy equipment from A to B. And so they weren't, you know, using little city vehicles that they were worried about wear and tear on. They were just trying to get from A to B as quickly as possible. And over time, those roads were maybe adopted by the general public or the state of Tassie. And they were, some of them were paved, some are slightly more maintained, but they kept just sort of this straight shot style. And so everything was so steep, steep up, steep down. And what that also means is that there's a lot more shifting. So I figured, based on past experience, I would need at least two derailleur batteries for a 30-ish hour ride, mixed surface ride with mountain biking and such, which innately has more shifting. But I've also learned over the course of a handful of these ultra rides that I've done at this point that you should always probably take one more of whatever you think you're going to need. And so I threw a second extra spare battery. And so obviously I had the battery on the derailleur that I started with, and then I had two additional batteries. And lo and behold, I went through all three. So I had a three-axis battery ride, which was definitely a first for me. Pretty wild. Why the Recon 3.0 shoe instead of the S-Works Recon? So I do most of my, well, actually all of my racing in the S-Works Recon. But the Recon 3.0 is a little bit more geared towards adventure riding. It has this really cool toe flex technology that makes walking much easier. It also has a slightly less stiff sole, carbon sole, which over the course of a really long ride is nice, a little bit easier on the feet. And then the other thing is it has like a Vibram sole. So the bottom of this shoe almost looks more like a hiking boot or a trail running shoe, which is really nice anytime you're going on an adventure ride. But it was especially nice on this route because there were so many river crossings and river fords. Hike a bike in general, both up and down, a lot of it's slippery, but really the trickiest bits on foot were crossing rivers where the bottoms are really cobbly and slippery and unpredictable. And you've got, you know, swift water up to the waist, as it turned out, in some places. So having that shoe was super nice. Okay, digging into the route and this project in general a little bit more, one of the first questions I got was just why. Fair enough. Somewhat, I guess, you know, I don't want to say this whole concept fell into my lap, but there certainly was no grand scheme to begin with. It definitely started with last year's ride from coast to coast across Iceland. And in that case, I was going to Iceland to join Lael and Chris Burkhardt and a couple of others for a tour around the West Fjords Way, which was a new 8-day, we were doing it in 8 days, tour around the West Fjords region of Iceland. But Burkhardt sort of offhandedly mentioned on one of the phone calls before we left that he thought there was a chance you could do a single push ride from coast to coast across Iceland. And he didn't think anyone had done it. He didn't think anyone had even thought about doing it, but he just sort of dropped it as an idea. And of course, it sounded pretty interesting right off the bat to me. So he and I started kind of digging into some maps and developing a route. And I ended up tackling that challenge a few days after our West Fjords tour and did the first human-powered crossing of Iceland from coast to coast in a day. Took about 20 hours, and it was one of the coolest, at the time, the coolest bike experience I'd ever had. And I immediately, you know, gears started turning about how that concept could be applied other places around the world, because riding a route that had sort of geographical anchor points like that, where you literally, I couldn't have kept riding if I wanted to, because you'd be swimming in the ocean. And that was cool at a really basic level, but it was also just an absolutely unbelievable way to see the place and get to know the place and just really be immersed in it. And that one, the ride across Iceland was still, I was being competitive with myself, you could say. There was no fastest known time to chase since it was a first, but I still had this kind of arbitrary goal of wanting to do it in 24 hours or less. It just felt like a cool benchmark. So I went after that. And moving forward and looking around the rest of the world, I noticed that there were many other places you could apply this concept theoretically, but on paper, many of them could not be done in a day or less. And so I started letting go of that benchmark and realized, you know, actually, it's really healthy for me to go on some bike adventures that are not competitive, that are not time-based. And I'll kind of get into this personal journey a little more later. But as we were putting this route together, the original concept was to ride the Tasmanian Trail, which is a 290-mile route from the southern tip of Tasmania, and it goes, cuts north all the way up to the northern coast. And like I said, it's 290 miles. But the more I looked into it, the more, at first it seemed perfect. You know, okay, here's a standardized route. Certainly no one's done it in less than a day. But it seemed to leave out a significant amount of what Tasmania was about. And the more I researched Tasmania, just the more diverse I realized it seemed to be geographically, geologically, in terms of the inhabitants, both humans and animals. And I didn't want to miss all that. And so I was a little bit at a loss of what to do there. And so I started kind of tacking on little extra bits along the Tasmanian Trail, sort of awkwardly trying to make my own route, mostly staring at heat maps on Strava and stuff and trying to pull up these weird obscure segments on Strava, you know, that would have 5 or 6 or 7 people on it, which pretty quickly intrigued me. You know, what are these little segments that almost no one gets to? And over time, I realized that there was this name that just kept popping up on these segments, Emma Flukes. And I was just like, who is this Emma Flukes person? And after a couple of weeks, I finally just said, you know what? I need to figure out who this person is. I bet they would be an incredible local resource. And I happened to click on one of her, when her name was on one of the segments, and it pulled up a ride where she rode across Tasmania from coast to coast. And I was like, son of a bitch, someone's already done this. And her route was north to south, but did not follow the Tasmanian Trail. It was a little over 300 miles. And so I found her on social media, and I just started hammering her with questions, and she was kind enough to answer them and seemed to have some enthusiasm and for my interest in coming to Tasmania. And basically she said, you know what, doing something along the lines of the Tasmanian Trail does just leave a whole bunch of stuff out. Would you consider basically riding a totally new route? And I said, yeah, of course. And so then the question was, do we go north, south, or west, east? And in my research regarding Tasmania, I'd learned that these roaring 40s winds just kind of rip around. They're these on a global scale, this sort of wind system, current of air that moves around the world, and they sort of slam into the western coast of Tasmania. And I thought, well, heck, prevailing westerly winds during a point-to-point ride west to east sound pretty awesome. Nothing sounds much cooler than surfing a tailwind for 300 plus miles all the way across an unusual, unknown island. Come to find out, Tasmania is so mountainous that once those winds hit Tasmania, they start splitting off and going in all kinds of different directions, and you definitely don't have a prevailing west to east wind all the way across Tasmania. But it kind of set the hook, and so I sort of kept nudging the conversation towards a route that went west to east. And sure enough, it seemed like a really good way to see some of the best that Tassie has to offer as well. So to this day, I really can't believe how much time she dedicated to it, but Emma was kind enough to put together a route that we kind of further refined together, but we just sort of kept tacking on more things. She'd say, well, how about this section? This has a really cool little double track that no one rides, and you go through a crazy river crossing. There's an amazing view, blah, blah, blah. Okay, yeah, let's do it. Or there's this single track section. You could tack on, you know, 15 miles of single track in Derby, which is this amazing trail system that's been voted rider's favorite EWS round for the last 2 years running. Yeah, of course, let's do that. That sounds amazing. Because I really wanted to do a route on my mountain bike too. So the more gnarly stuff we threw in there, the more I was going to need a mountain bike over a gravel bike. So long story short, we ended up with this monster 360-mile route, well over 30,000 feet of climbing, starting on the west coast in Arthur River, which I'll get into more in a minute, and traversing all the way across over to the eastern coast. And so all that to say, I very much had to let go of this idea of doing it in 24 hours or less, and instead really leaned into what kind of route is going to let me see the most of this place, learn the most of this place, interact with the most of this place in a single push from coast to coast. So that's kind of some explanation as to the why. I guess on a broader note, kind of like I touched on earlier, another why is just because I feel like this is the best way to see the world. Inevitably, with a big mission like this, you meet people. You get in touch with the place, you see things, you hear things, you smell things, you feel things, all that sort of thing. But I got to know this incredible local ultra cyclist, Emma. With there being a film production aspect, I knew we would need a lot of on-the-ground help and know-how, and so there was all kinds of networking that happened before the fact, and then all kinds of interaction with some really interesting folks while we were actually there putting the plans together. And that was one thing that I felt like, because the Iceland crossing was pretty last minute, we'd missed. I certainly enjoyed interacting with the local crews that we hired there, but it was so short notice, we just didn't have that much time to immerse ourselves with the locals. And this time around, we prioritized that much more, and there was just huge payoff. And then lastly, because I was able to eventually kind of let go of a speed goal, I took the time to stop at, you know, a couple of the local resupply points that I hit and really interact with the store clerks and ask them a little bit about themselves. I stopped in Derby at the bike shop when I was, I don't know, 28 hours into my ride, to thank the owner of the shop who'd popped a new bottom bracket in my bike right before we left. So that was really fun too. And one of the big reasons I like to do this is just immersion in the place on all fronts. I guess quickly I'll kind of walk through the route. So the route started on the far northwestern coast of Tasmania in this tiny little community called Arthur River. And one of the reasons I wanted to start there is because it's the beginning of this really incredible 70-mile stretch of road called the Western Explorer, which is gravel, has little to no vehicular traffic. I didn't see a car until 5 hours into my ride. And it traverses the Tarkine rainforest, which is one of the largest remaining subtropical rainforests. But that coastline, which is nicknamed Edge of the World, felt pretty special in a couple of regards as well, because it's nicknamed Edge of the World because if you look to the horizon into the ocean, if you can imagine just traveling that way past the horizon line, you would not hit land again for 20,000 kilometers, 12,000 miles, until you finally hit South America, Patagonia, Argentina there, on the southern end of Patagonia. It is the longest unbroken stretch of ocean in the world. And so it's nicknamed Edge of the World. But another aspect of that is that huge uninterrupted stretch of ocean combined with the roaring 40 winds that I mentioned earlier create the spot for the cleanest air in the world, because those winds carry all the way around the world, and that air doesn't pick up any sort of, you know, contaminants from land masses and whatever humans are living there on their way to this little bit of the Tasmanian coast. And so the cleanest air has been measured there, and it is the zero reference point for pollution in the world. But that was the start of the ride. Went through that opening 70-mile section that I mentioned, which was incredible because you sort of dive into these deep rainforest sections with massive Jurassic Park style trees and huge, huge ferns, lots of moss. It's cool, dark. And then you'll pop up on a ridgeline and all of a sudden it almost looks like African savanna, these huge mountain ranges, tall, tall, spindly eucalyptus trees. And what struck me during that section is it doesn't feel like you're on an island at all, let alone one the size of Wisconsin. It just feels so vast, so untouched, so wild. That section ends at around mile 70 at the Savage River Mine, which is this huge industrial mine. And it was really striking, the little mining community there. You know, this is true, like, hard working blue collar stuff. And it was pretty striking to see because, and you know, no matter where in the world you live, some product we rely on, something you love, something you probably use every day, had origin materials from a mine not unlike that. And so it's interesting. It was interesting to see that and to see the, you know, the dichotomy of this absolutely unbelievably beautiful natural environment combined with, you know, this reminder of human presence. And then moving on from there, I started to approach, after a long pavement climb, beautiful, twisty, but long pavement climb that got pretty hot too. surprisingly hot. It started to push into the low 80s, which on blacktop starts to get pretty warm. I started to approach the Waratah community, which is one of the westernmost communities in Tasmania. Pretty working class, like I said before, is there to kind of serve a lot of the mining community. Very friendly people, but small town, my first opportunity for resupply. And I could have just shot along this little two-lane highway straight to Waratah, but in the name of adventure and seeing the path less traveled, Emma and I decided to tack on what I eventually nicknamed the Waratah Snake Pit, which is this old mining road that turns left off the highway, drops way down into this valley, and then sort of deteriorates into a little bit of a goat track trail that eventually just turns into this submerged, boggy mess that's just running water. It basically turns into a riverbed, a running creek, water, you know, almost up to the hubs and sections before you kind of start meandering your way up the hillside back towards the community of Waratah. And this extra loop adds only about 10 miles, but it has about 1,000 feet of climbing, and is nicknamed the Waratah Snake Pit because when I was taking a peek at it in the days beforehand, I saw a huge tiger snake, which is scary. The locals reinforced for me many times that snake bites are rare and fatalities even rarer. But even so, when you see one, it's pretty striking. They're really big, they're jet black, and they are one of the most venomous snakes in the world. It's just the way it is. And I couldn't help but have a pretty visceral reaction to that. So dropping in day of when I had to ride through the whole thing, I'll note that when I was looking at it in the days beforehand, and the reason I dropped in there to look at it is because Emma mentioned that it was a section that she actually had never ridden. And so she wasn't totally clear if it went through. And I turned around. I didn't actually loop the whole thing, and there were still question marks about if it went through day of because of this massive tiger snake that was right in the middle of the route. I just said, you know what? I don't want to deal with that today. But day of, there was another one down there, just as big. And this time I didn't see him until the last minute and came within about 6 inches of him. Luckily, they're pretty shy and he slithered off. But yeah. The Waratah Snake Pit. Then I did a quick resupply in Waratah. And then you kind of get into this beautiful plateau section. And the middle section of this route is a mix of relatively fast, like dirt road, double track, and some pavement. A few key dicey river crossings, which I'll get into. And then at mile 205, you get to Deloraine, which theoretically on paper was my second resupply opportunity. And then there's a long stretch, 40-ish miles of dead flat pavement, really, that I mentioned earlier, before you reach the final third of this route, which is where it gets really gnarly. It's super backloaded, this route. The last 100 miles, I think, had 12,000 feet of climbing, really slow going double track in sections, totally like deteriorated, eroded 4x4 track. The biggest drop-in descent of the day, you actually have to walk many sections of. And then the last 50 miles is almost all trail, including Derby and the 24-mile Bay of Fires trail, which is this incredible 24-mile, turns out really challenging trail that drops you off right at the Bay of Fires and my finish line in the eastern coast of Tassie. Next question. Was it a hard decision to settle on Tasmania? Did you have other options? Yes, definitely have other options. I have a whole list of places that I'd like to look into doing similar missions like this, developing routes. Some are kind of halfway in the works already. Some are very theoretical and just like jotted in the back of a notebook. But Tassie was the place that I really started to get obsessed with early in the year. The more I looked into it, the more I was fascinated by the wildlife, the history, and honestly, how much or how little information there was. That was the thing that just kept striking me, is repeatedly I would hit dead ends in my research, or I would bring up the place to someone in conversation, they say, yeah, you know, you never really hear anything about Tassie other than the Tasmanian devil. So that's really why I kind of sunk my teeth into it. And eventually, once I really started breaking through on research and made contact with local Tasmanians, that's really when I knew this was the place for the next one. But there will be another crossing next year. And obviously it will not be in Tasmania, new location. What is it about crossing islands that interests you? Was it Iceland that catalyzed it? Yeah, like I mentioned earlier, it was Iceland that kind of catalyzed all of this. And, you know, to begin with, like I said earlier, the concept, like the athletic aspect, the achievement aspect intrigued me. Like, can you ride from coast to coast across a big landmass in a single push? From a competitive, goals-driven mindset, which so much of my cycling experience has revolved around for so long, that was really intriguing. But now, as of finishing Tasmania, and I have a sample size of two of these things, I've realized that really what intrigues me about crossing an island like this or visiting places like this in general is that they almost feel like their own little planets, because there's, when you think about it, an island is almost like a little parallel universe, little planet. When you visit one, you'll know what I mean. The animals there are typically different. You know, they evolved in a little bit different direction. There are animals in Tasmania that are nowhere else in the world. The people typically are a little bit different. You know, there's a certain boundary there innately as an island that kind of creates some unique culture. A lot of times these islands have really interesting, unique histories, from how they were discovered to their indigenous people to, you know, whether they were colonized. Obviously, a lot of that history is quite dark, but they're inevitably, there's really rich history there, and that's intriguing. And so the more I've immersed myself in a place, whether it's Iceland or Tassie, the more I've come to realize just how these places feel like little planets or parallel universes in and of themselves. And, you know, you often hear there probably is life out there on some other planet, and it probably is shockingly similar to life here on Earth. And sometimes I think that about somewhere like Tasmania, where you find a platypus or you find the Tasmanian devil, which basically looks like a supersized rat, or, you know, these ferns that are just enormous and have changed almost not at all since the Jurassic period. Highly, highly recommend a visit if you can make it happen. What is the experience of just crossing a whole landmass like? How did it compare to Iceland? Well, I sort of described just now what it's like to visit one of these places. Riding across in a single push, you know, obviously you get to see a lot. It really, the fatigue, of course, strips away, in my experience, strips a lot of stuff away that makes you able to soak more of the place in. It's just such an incredible immersion experience to ride across one of these places in one go. While you're actually doing it, you don't actually feel like you're crossing a place per se, because you don't have some bird's eye view reference point, unless you were to, you know, zoom out the map a bunch on your head unit or whatever. But what is cool is how the place just sort of unfolds in front of your eyes. And because these are, you know, largely exploratory adventure discovery missions for me, I you know, haven't seen the majority of the route, obviously, before I do it. It's just so exciting to see what's around the next bend. Anyone that's done a new route will know how special that feeling is, even in your own backyard. When you discover a new road, a new trail, and you link something new together, that discovery experience is so amazing. But imagine doing that in a completely foreign land for a full day or a day and a half, and everything is new and exciting, and it's so engaging. And 32 hours sounds like a ridiculously long time to ride a bike, and in many respects it is. But it stays so fresh and engaging the whole time. At least Tassie did. In Iceland, that was different in some regards, because that central highland plateau is so barren of life. You know, it's like a highland desert, I think. And so it's just this vast nothingness of just glaciers and volcanoes and some glacial rivers. And so it was a lot mentally more challenging, Iceland was in that regard. In a lot of ways, it was the polar opposite of Tassie, which is just exploding with life. And literally, there's so much wildlife. It's hard to avoid hitting things as they run across in front of you. And there's so much diversity. So in that way, they were kind of opposites, I would say. Okay, so now we're going to move on to some conversation. Well, I've sort of slipped into talking a lot of during stuff, but this will be maybe slightly more detailed storytelling and answering some more detailed questions about the actual during process. What did your training program look like leading up to your epic ride? Honestly, kind of disastrous. Heading into Big Sugar, which was my last race of the year, that was a really, really big goal. And I was in a great position in the Grand Prix. So I put a lot into training for that event specifically, which means, you know, 5-6 weeks out from Tasmania, which is 3 weeks out from Big Sugar, I was not doing any Tasmania related preparation. I was doing all Big Sugar preparation. And then you rest a whole bunch going into Big Sugar, of course. But unfortunately, I got really, really sick the night before Big Sugar, couldn't even race. And so I was really rested, and then I continued to struggle with that illness for the entire 2 weeks before crossing Tasmania, which meant that for all intents and purposes, I had 3 weeks of just rest, which was not ideal. The fitness definitely dropped. I was not able to get, you know, the big 1 or 2 10-hour rides, 8-10-hour rides in that I'd like. Typically before something like a big crossing, I like to do a big 8 or 10-hour ride or two, as much to test equipment and nutrition and all that sort of thing as from a physical standpoint, and just kind of start adapting mentally to that sort of mindset. But I wasn't really able to do any of that. And it didn't, you know, again, this Tassie ride wasn't an FKT per se, so I wasn't too worried from a performance standpoint, but it probably made it a little harder. And it also, you know, didn't give me the opportunity to let my body adapt to a heavier loaded bike. So my knees really started to complain, as an example, during the ride, in part because of all the steep climbing. Achilles started to complain a little, all that sort of thing. But I'd say the diciest thing that happened is the day before we were meant to leave, I was riding the South Trails in Austin, Texas, as they're called, and had a pretty violent head-on collision with another cyclist on a trail that just had a really blind turn. And on impact, I immediately felt my shoulder sublux, it's called. And for a second, I thought I might have even dislocated it. But it's basically when the ball of your humerus shifts in the socket just a little bit. And I definitely tore some stuff and kind of had a little contusion there, and it's still sore. But that was pretty sketchy and you know, a little bit of an ache and pain during the crossing, but luckily didn't impact things too much. How many calories did you burn, and what was the nutrition plan? According to Training Peaks, I wasn't wearing a heart rate monitor, so this data would be based off of a power meter, which didn't capture everything, all the calorie burn, because there was a lot of hike a bike, but according to Training Peaks, it was a little over 20,000 calories burned, which obviously you cannot keep up with. You simply cannot ingest enough food, stomach enough food, process enough food to keep up with that. So I was running a big deficit over the course of the ride. But obviously the goal, just like in racing, is to kind of slow the bleed, so to speak. And so I was shooting for around 75 grams of carbohydrate per hour as best I could, which is less than I would racing. But obviously the burn rate's a little lower during something this long. And then also you just can't digest stuff as well come hour 10, 12, 14, 20, 30. So I'd say the biggest difference too from a fueling standpoint as opposed to racing is that I tried to keep it a lot more diverse and mix in more real foods. And so even though I had that plan going in, I ended up wishing I had even more real food and really loaded up on that during one of my resupply points. But yeah, that was kind of the general strategy. Favorite snack? Well, I found these really awesome big kind of like full-size Belgian waffles that I could pack. They were sprinkled with sugar. Those definitely hit the spot, seemed to stick to the ribs really well. And then there's also this gummy candy in Tassie. And we've also found it here in New Zealand called, it's by this, I can't remember the name of the company. It's like the Natural, maybe the Natural Confectioners, the company. But it doesn't have any artificial color or artificial flavor, but they're gummy snacks. And for some reason, the snake ones were the best. I think I went through like three packs of those, which was just an ungodly amount of sugar and carbs, but kept the engine turning over. How do you prepare for a ride of this duration when most of your races are entirely different requirements? Well, like I mentioned a minute ago, this go around, I didn't really have the opportunity to prepare as I would have liked, but really it's just spending time on the gear that you're going to use. There's really diminishing returns in terms of training hours when you go really long. And by that, I've said this on the podcast before, but there's a much bigger difference physiologically in the adaptation you get between a 3-hour ride and a 4-hour ride versus a 6-hour ride and a 7-hour ride. And especially once you get up to like a 10-hour ride versus a 12-hour ride. And so it's much less about logging some crazy like 14-hour ride beforehand and more practicing with the gear, helping your body adapt to what it's like to do steep climbs, grindy climbs with a weighed down bike. And then practicing fueling and just sitting on a bike for a while is helpful too. And the mindset aspect. So typically I would just try to log 2 or 3 pretty long rides practicing with the gear that I want to use. And then also a couple of rides in the dark, just because it's a very different experience. There's a little bit of confidence component there that I think is important. And yeah, just testing the lights and all that sort of thing. What was the least expected challenge? Well, everyone warned me about this, all the locals did, but honestly, not hitting wildlife, especially at night. I know that sounds silly, but the sheer volume of wildlife in Tasmania is just totally out of control. And it got so intense that at night I actually ended up, I stopped riding the aero bars at all, even when I could have, because I wanted my fingers just really hovering over the brake levers to be able to take evasive action. The wallabies are the worst. They are kind of like our deer in North America, where they're really unpredictable. They don't seem to be able to decide what they want to do a lot of the time. And they're really fast. And they're kind of the same color as darkness. So that was pretty dicey. Had 3 very close calls with them, full like lockup skid. But luckily was able to avoid it every time. Also the wombats, which are like these... Imagine like a 70-pound bear, like brown-colored grizzly bear with this very sort of flat face but really stubby legs. They're actually way faster than you'd expect based on what they look like, but they're just dense. And if you hit one, it's like hitting a huge pile of bricks. Like, you are over the bars immediately, or so I'm told. But luckily, I was able to avoid all of those. Another least expected challenge was the Bay of Fires trail. Emma had sort of told me how glorious it would be to finish the route with that, because it's this 24-mile beautiful single track descent all the way down to the coast. Turns out this 24-mile descent also somehow had about 3,500 feet of climbing hidden in it. And so with literally like 6 or 7 miles to go in the route, this climb, the single track climb that I swear just would never end, was just punching me in the face and was just like this force from the universe. Just like, it felt like the universe was telling me that I was never going to finish. And this climb, you know, it was, I don't know, 1,000-foot climb or something, which sounds big, but hidden amongst a bunch of 1,000-plus-foot climbs or even 2,000-foot climbs on a course profile, it really kind of blended in and I overlooked it. And it was definitely a very challenging last challenge. Other things that were challenging were the river crossings, but I'll kind of get into that more in a minute because those were more expected challenges, I would say. Was it harder than Iceland? Overall, yes, for sure. But I never had quite as an acute, like, holy shit, I might have to quit right now moment, which I did have in Iceland. Iceland just felt, it was so exposed, and it felt like I was more vulnerable the whole time, for sure. It was certainly shorter, technically a far easier route. I don't mean technically like bike handling wise, but just on paper, far easier, and that's how it felt too while I was doing it. But there was a moment like 150 miles in during Iceland where I was just losing total function of my hands, and I wasn't sure that my body was going to hold up. So that was pretty sketchy at the time. But overall, Tasmania was definitely significantly harder. The only route that I've done that compares to Tasmania, or this route we did, was actually the Colorado Trail. And the Colorado Trail was definitely still more of a beatdown. Certainly, I don't know that anything will ever come close to the Colorado Trail, but this was certainly second for me. Single hardest moment, probably the Mercy River crossing. So let's talk about river crossings for a minute. Tassie's a pretty wet place, but in the couple of weeks beforehand, they had some really serious flooding. Flooding so significant, in fact, that a bunch of trails got washed out. There were mudslides, landslides, and bridges got washed out. And so there was a big question mark going into the route about this bridge that goes over the River Leven that was completely washed out. Big, like, two-lane road bridge. This is not some little rickety wooden bridge. This is a big paved road bridge, 20, 30 feet above the river typically, that just got torn out. Funny enough, it ended up being super anticlimactic and was only like mid-thigh deep, and I was able to just walk right across it with my bike kind of at my shoulder. But later in the ride, after dark, shortly before Deloraine, I linked up with a section of the Tasmanian Trail. My route just happened to end up using, I think it was like, I don't know, 10 miles of the Tasmanian Trail or so. And there's this pretty famous river ford on the Tassie Trail called the Mercy River Ford. And we'd driven across the Mercy River on our way to the start a couple of days beforehand, different section of the river, but it was upstream of this ford. I hope this is making sense. And as we were driving, I was constantly on my phone, just kind of scoping out where we were. Because on the one hand, I was very curious about this place, of course, very excited to be there, but also just trying to get an idea of, are we on route right now? Or is the route nearby? Can I get a feel for terrain as we're driving to the start here and what I might be facing? And so we drove over this River Mercy, and I noticed, oh man, at some point I'm going to be crossing the River Mercy. And, oh, it looks like it's downstream of this. And whoa, this bridge we're driving over right now, this river looks really big, like really big. And it looks fast. It looks like it's higher than is typical. And it immediately just lingered in the back of my head for the next 2 days. Like, what is this river ford going to be? Because on my route map, it says River Mercy Ford, which meant there's no bridge. It's a ford. And so I rolled up on it at about, I don't know, 9:30 at night maybe. And it was pitch black, and I rolled down to the water, and it was huge, huge. I couldn't tell how deep it was in the dark, but I, even with my really bright light, I could barely see the other bank on the other side. I'm sure I'm exaggerating, but in the dark, it looked like it was at least a quarter mile away. It was probably, I don't know, 100 yards, a couple hundred yards or something, but it looked really intimidating, and it was deep, as it turned out. It was over my waist, and I had to get pretty creative with packing all of my electronics. I transferred them to the bags on my bike, and then I carried my bike overhead which was tricky in and of itself, but I got across literally right as my arms were really starting to give out. In hindsight, this would have been an amazing place for the film crew to be hiding in the bushes documenting this, but this will be an experience only I know about. And then I got to the other side and it was just this thick tangle of like driftwood and flotsam from the flooding. And I was just like, oh my God, this is exactly what tiger snakes love to hang out in. And theoretically these things, you know, curl up and go to bed at night. But, in the middle of the night when it's dark and you've already seen two tiger snakes that day, it, you know, gets in your head a little bit. But, I made it through. But long story short, that was absolutely one of the, hardest moments mentally. I'd say hardest moment physically was either the top of the Blue Tier, which is a pretty famous, it's actually a kind of an old abandoned downhill track, but I went up it, of course. Thanks, Emma. And it was just brutal. Like, hike a bike, 300 miles in, 320 miles in. That was really tough. And then, of course, that Surprise Bay of Fires trail that I mentioned earlier was a very, very hard moment. What was the scariest part? Either that River Mercy Ford or the Waratah Snake Pit. Just kind of it's hard to describe like the foreboding feeling of turning left off of that perfectly good highway that went straight to Waratah, but knowing that I had to just make it through this 10-mile, like, extracurricular lap we tacked on just for the hell of it, that had tiger snakes in it. And yeah, had to get through it. That was dicey. And everyone told me that these tiger snakes bite people very rarely, and that it's an unusual occurrence and to not worry about it, and that they're shy and all that sort of thing. But there's something so primal, like it gets under your skin, or at least it does for me. And typically, you know, I'm not someone that's super afraid of snakes. Like I'll be startled and my stomach will turn over, but I don't have any trouble holding them, or whatever. But, yeah, these snakes got in my head for sure. So that was scary. Pete, one of our drivers, was kind enough to give me some beta on what to do in the unlikely chance that I did get bit, and reference kind of the old indigenous people's way of doing things, which is basically if you get bit, you sit down immediately, drop your heart rate as fast as you can, and just wait for help, because their venom has this I forget what the term is, but basically it can travel through your body very quickly and start to do damage. And so if you can slow that spread by dropping your heart rate, dropping your respiratory rate, all that sort of thing, that's the thing to do. So not that it was likely to come to it, but the plan was sit down, hit the SOS button and wait for the helicopter. Cause, you don't necessarily have a very long time. What techniques did you use to stay motivated? I sort of do it like by default now, but, I find myself breaking the route into chunks mentally. So like I just mentioned, get through the Waratah Snake Pit, and then you have the reward of a nice resupply in Waratah to get all kinds of fun snacks and drinks. Then make it to, you know, the Levin River crossing, and that's going to be a challenge that you can look forward to, but it's, you know, sort of another bookmark in the route. Then make it to Deloraine, which was going to be a resupply point. Then make it through the long flat pavement section. Then make it up onto the Mount Maurice Plateau, and then make it to Derby. So you just sort of like mentally break it into chunks automatically, in my experience. But the other thing that really helped on this route mentally and for staying motivated, I mentioned earlier, which is that it's just so engaging. You see so much. There's so many surprises around every turn. There's always something happening. You're always climbing or descending. You're always, you know, picking a line. There's always something, you know, some amazing view or some crazy animal or bird or a plant you've never seen. At no point is this route boring, like not once. Favorite bit of the route: for scenery, forget the leg feels. This one is courtesy of Emma. That's a tough one. Something that will always stick in my mind was watching sunrise from the plateau up on that Mount Maurice section. From the plateau, which is up at about a little over 2,000 feet, you look off and there's these beautiful mountains off on the horizon. And at that very early pre-dawn, the light just started to kind of collect in the troughs of those faraway mountains. And it was just, God, it's so amazing. So beautiful. It's giving me chills right now just to remember it. And one of the things that if you've ridden through the night and watched the sunrise, one thing you know is how long sunrise can be. The light show that happens is, you know, it's not 20 minutes. A lot of people think of sunset and it comes and it goes and you wish that it would linger longer. But if you really sit there, or in this case, ride, and you're able to just watch the show, so to speak, you know, sunrise or sunset is really like a 2-hour process. And there's so many different stages of that changing light. And it's really something else. Also on the list would be that Western Explorer route, like I mentioned earlier. Just so wild and diverse and just beautiful. And that white gravel is just so striking. There was also a really beautiful bit on this plateau, pretty high up, pretty early on. I think it was kind of looking towards the Black Bluff Nature Recreation Area that hopefully will kind of let Emma know what I'm talking about. Probably won't make sense to anybody else, but it was actually an area that had been logged, which sounds counterintuitive, but it really opened up some incredible sight lines over onto some mountains that were just seemed really especially beautiful. How many people did you meet along the way? Really not many. You know, chit-chatted with the clerk at the store in Waratah, chatted with the owner of Barkoff Bike Shop in Derby. I actually stopped in there, took the time to stop at like hour 28 just to thank him again. One of his employees, Alex, who's since become a great friend of Nicole and mine, dropped a new bottom bracket into my bike right before I left. And I don't know why, but in my delirium, I wanted to drop by and thank him again. So I did. But I'd say really the most memorable human interaction was at the Deloraine grocery store, which I mentioned earlier was mile 205. And for almost the entire ride before that, on paper, I was going to make that store before it closed with plenty of room to spare. But shortly before getting to that store, the route just really started to deteriorate for 15 or 20 miles and just got so slow, really climby, boggy surface. And there was that big River Mercy crossing right there beforehand. And all of a sudden, I wasn't going to make the store. And sure enough, I missed it by 8 minutes. The store closes at 10 p.m. and I rolled in at 10:08. And the film crew knew, they could tell it was going to be pretty touch and go, I think. And so they'd actually decided to roll in there a little beforehand and get their dinner there. And I guess the staff had heard that there was some crazy guy trying to ride his bike across in a day, or they were asking, you know, what the film crew was doing or something. Anyway, they started talking about what was going on. And Nicole and Zach and the crew, they were like, yeah, you know, it's going to be really close if he's going to make it, but we want to capture his reaction if he doesn't make it. Obviously be there to see the resupply process if he does make it. And the store clerks were like, well, we've never seen anything like this. Like, we're definitely staying open regardless. And so I rolled in. I didn't know any of this, of course, beforehand, but I rolled in 10:08, a little crestfallen. I had plenty of food. Like, I really loaded up. Because I had a feeling, loaded up in Waratah, because I had a feeling I might not make the Deloraine store. But I'd gotten kind of like fixated on making the store, because you just, like I said earlier, you sort of make these mental goals just because it's something to shoot for. And if you think about the right ride and the route in totality, it's just overwhelming. So you kind of make these mini process-based goals. And so when I rolled in and missed it by a few minutes, yeah, I was kind of bummed. But I think it was Pete who's like, hey, man, they stayed open for you. And I was like, you know, that's nice of them, but that's not really how I roll. That's not what would happen for the average rider just doing this route. That feels like kind of crossing a line for me when it comes to self-supported. And then I looked in the window, and I just saw all of these young faces looking out the window, just kind of agape. So then I was like, okay, fine. And I ended up staying there far too long, just kind of wandering the aisles, chit-chatting with the employees, and it was awesome. It was exactly the sort of, you know, serendipitous moment that I've really come to love about these things, and it was fun to share a few minutes there with some folks that live in this, you know, very small farming community in the middle of Tasmania. Okay. Just mention the film team. What was the size of the production team and what were some of the highlights of the logistics? We had quite the team this go around. Covering and documenting these sorts of rides is so hard. And the truth is, you never are able to do one of these things justice. They're just way too big. Bikes are way too fast and efficient. I mean, you would need like you'd need 10 groups of 5 people, you know, 10 different vehicles, weeks of scouting on motos and e-bikes and everything else to really do the route justice from a visual standpoint. But that's okay. You know, much of these rides, I think, should be left to just the rider, and stay special as solo experiences for just the rider. Despite, you know, the presence of a film team in it. And I really do love sharing these rides and sharing these places. More and more, it's becoming about the place and the people that call the place home and the animals that call the place home rather than the athletic aspect. You know, more and more I'm feeling, there was a time where like doing some crazy athletic thing obviously was appealing. But I'm realizing how much more gratifying it is to make more of the story about all the stuff other than that. And so this go around, thanks to really incredible support from all the brand partners, we had a much better budget than for Iceland. And so we had a bigger team, had more days there to scout and film and make a plan and all that sort of thing. But even so, it just felt like, I know that the crew felt like they were coming up short frequently, and that's just the filmmaking process with something like this, with an adventure film. So, we did the best we could. We had 2 vehicles, 2 local drivers who also will feature in the film, Pete and Gareth. If you go back a couple of weeks and listen to the crew recap episode, you can hear from them. They are awesome, good friends now. We also had Thrawn, who is one of my all-time favorite photographers who lives in Iceland. Nicole, of course, who has a very good idea of how quickly I'll be moving through terrain, what I might be thinking, and is just sort of like this overarching voice of reason a lot of times, and also happens to be kind of a logistical magician. Zach Caputo, who's a longtime friend of mine and was sort of like director/producer, helped a lot with logistics, keeping everyone on schedule, having an overall plan, keeping track of the shot list, schedule, all that sort of thing. And then 2 all-star videographers, filmmakers, and Joey Schusler and Thomas Woodson. Big shout out to them for just recently winning Best Mountain Adventure Film at Banff Mountain Film Fest. Way cool. These 2 guys are just veterans at this point, really sought after, and couldn't be more thrilled to have them on this project. So all told, there were 7 in that production team. Do you reckon there's a few Tassie tigers still out there? For those that don't know, the Tasmanian tiger technically is extinct. It was the largest marsupial in the world. Now the Tasmanian devil is the largest remaining marsupial, carnivorous marsupial, I should say. The Tasmanian tiger was definitely kind of an apex predator in Tasmania. Pretty impressive looking animal that was killed off in the early 1900s. And there are all kinds of tall tales about a few being left in Tasmania. And before I went to Tassie, you know, I sort of would laugh and kind of roll my eyes a little bit, sort of like a Sasquatch, Yeti kind of idea. But I have to say, having spent time in Tasmania, I still think that Tasmanian tigers are extinct. But having seen that place, how ridiculously wild it is, how untouched so much of it feels, and also how dense so much of the vegetation is. I mean, you can be riding and look, you know, riding on a road or trail and look left or look right and only be able to see, like, no exaggeration, 2 feet into the forest because the vegetation is so ridiculously thick, and it immediately, it's just like dark beyond the little bit you can see. And I came away thinking, you know what? If a theoretically extinct animal is going to hide in plain sight anywhere in the world, it's probably Tasmania. Tell us about your playlist from Chris Burkhard. Thanks for the question, Chris. It's funny that he's the one to ask that because I don't think he would have had no way of knowing this, but he has an incredible playlist that he put together on Spotify called Death Ride, all caps, which he made for his circumnavigation of Iceland a handful of years ago. And it's awesome. It's so good that I listened to it throughout the year. It hasn't gotten old yet. And I listened to it. It's a long playlist. And I listened to it no less than 3 times in the last 10 hours of my Tassie crossing. Other go-tos for me, as always, was Boards of Canada. And I even listened to a couple of Bill Simmons podcasts, believe it or not, during this ride. Did you ever question the water sources? No, not really. There's water everywhere, lots of rivers, lots of creeks. It has a really strange color there. It's got this deep amber color that actually makes it fairly opaque, and it looks not good. It's pretty striking when you look at it, but evidently it's all just natural, like organic matter breakdown, sort of the tannins from like all the ferns and stuff. I did filter the water, but I know Emma doesn't even bother filtering the water really ever. But no, never had any questions about that. Are the numb fingers back to life? So some of y'all will have seen on my Instagram story that the two last fingers, my ring finger and pinky, on both hands went numb during the ride, not from cold, nerve thing, and were really weird nerve-wise in the days afterward. But those have gotten better. One sort of lingering nerve thing I still have, which is a little disconcerting, but it is getting better, so I'm not too worried about it, is my lower leg. I'm not really sure what that's about, but basically my calf and ankle and down to my foot have a tendency to like get that feeling where they go to sleep, weirdly, especially when I'm sitting on the toilet, just on the right leg. And every day it's there a little bit less, there less frequently. But it's the first time it's happened, and it's definitely a little disconcerting. Would you do it again? I would love to ride this route again. Not in a single push. I would take, actually, you know what I would do is I would ride to probably Waratah the first day and stay in some sort of little inn or lodge or bed and breakfast in Waratah. And then I would ride to Deloraine on the second day, and stay there. And then I would ride from Deloraine to Derby and stay there. And then I would ride Derby to the coast. So it would be 4 days, I guess, with sleeping involved. And I would also love to explore more of Tasmania in general and plan to. We have completely fallen in love with this place and plan to be back sooner than later. And I really look forward to exploring more of the island. But no, I don't think I would ever want to do this route in a single push again. One of the things that I think allows me to do them mentally and motivation-wise is that they're discovery missions. Now that I know how absurdly hard this route is, I don't know that I could bring myself, you know, get up to it mentally again. Would you want to race at this scale, or do you think that it would corrupt the experience? Great, great question. I'm glad I wasn't 100% head down trying to set some sort of record or like absolutely go the fastest I could on this route. I would have missed some of the experiences that I had. I am interested in bike pack racing, absolutely. But for this sort of mission, these crossings, I'm enjoying them becoming more of experiential rides rather than cut and dried athletic endeavors. What do you think is the biggest significance of using a bike to cross large land masses? The bike is, I've said it many times and I'll just say it again. I think the bike is the single best way to learn a place, to get to know a place, to be in a place. It's the perfect speed. It's so efficient. Technically, it is the most efficient machine that humans have ever developed. And it's disarming to other people. I mean, no matter where you are, if you roll up on a bike, it's a common language, so to speak. And people are so much more willing, it seems, to interact with you, and barriers are immediately melted away. And yeah, you're just able to listen to things, see things, smell things, watch the world go by at a pace that feels right, but also allows you to see so much in a single day or day and a half. What do you feel that you learned from this experience? Amazing question. Still figuring that out. One of the things that I referenced in a post after the ride and something I wrote about in an upcoming article, and I imagine a theme for the film, will be this idea that so much of my bike experience, the relationship I have with the bike, has revolved around time to this point. Racing is time related. Training is always time related. There's always this pressure of time. And it makes sense. But in some ways, at this point in my life, I'm able to see that that's a real sacrifice. That's a trade-off. Because it suffocates and leaves out the opportunity for so much else that the bike can present. You know, the bike can be enjoyed in so many different ways and is enjoyed by people in so many different ways. But racing or bike competition is such a ridiculously narrow sliver of the total pie chart of the way a bike can bring joy or the bike can be experienced. And although, you know, for this crossing, I did have some goals in the back of my mind, process goals. I did, you know, choose equipment that I felt would allow me to move through the route efficiently and swiftly. Letting go of time in a way at the beginning was very helpful. And then throughout the entire ride, I found myself further letting go of time. And eventually, interestingly, by the time I got to that really heinous trail stuff in the last 30, 40, 50 miles where I was really starting to fall apart physically, mentally, I unlocked something that felt new to me, which was this acceptance, like surrender of control, where it felt like the route may never end. Like it was getting so hard there at the end. And there were so many surprise climbs, like that freaking 1,000-foot surprise climb just 6 miles from the finish. Just like I said, felt like this invisible hand that was holding me back. Like, you will not finish this route. And finishing almost became like this theoretical idea that might not actually exist. And maybe I was just bound for perpetual motion. Like this was my new existence, just to be some sort of piece of machinery whose sole purpose was forward movement, but I would never actually be allowed to stop chasing forward movement. but weirdly being okay with that and accepting, all right, there might be more surprise climbs. For all I know, in this last 5 miles, there's going to be 3 more 1,000-foot climbs. And feeling like this theoretical finish was like this disappearing horizon, but simultaneously I was this perpetual motion machine that was up to the task no matter what. Like, that was such a strange place to be. And so when I finally did finish, the finishing didn't feel like the accomplishment that it did in Iceland. It didn't, there wasn't this victorious, like, I did it in less than a day. I did it so fast. I did it in, you know, 32 hours is so good. I achieved like that true timelessness, and that felt so healthy, even though it feels pretty weird. And, you know, that something that extreme certainly isn't for everyone. There was something really, really powerful and special about that, that felt like sort of the antidote I needed to a really challenging, frustrating race season where it seemed like everything was going wrong. And no matter how much I tried to control the variables, bad luck just kept happening. And this ride was the opposite of that. Loads of bad luck would have been fine. It just would have added to the richness of the story. There was no time cutoff. There was no results sheet. It was just truly being in the moment without the pressure of time and just being in a place. And that was supremely special and something that I want to chase for many years to come, for sure. I think that might be it. The last thing I'll say is the film is going to be coming out in April of 2023. We're going to premiere it at the Sea Otter Classic. Exact date and time, obviously, to be determined, still a ways out. I would love to have this thing premiere at an actual little theater somewhere. I know there's a great one there in downtown Monterey where Sea Otter happens. And we'll be doing a handful of screenings around the country after that as well. We'll probably do a couple in Denver, imagine maybe one in Austin, Bentonville, all that sort of thing. So stay tuned for that. Thank you again, everyone, for submitting all of those questions. This will probably be a wrap on the Tassie Crossing related podcast for now. We'll pick up another one or two as we get close to that film premiere. But I hope you've enjoyed these. If you haven't heard the Emma Flukes conversation from last week or the crew recap from the week before, I highly recommend you go check those out. Really, really enjoyed being a part of those. And I think you would enjoy them if you haven't heard them yet either. All right. That's all she wrote. Hello again, everyone. Thank you so much for listening today. Hope you enjoyed that Q&A episode. If you would like to check out some imagery from the big adventure you just heard, you can go to my Instagram or the new Stash House Productions Instagram. That's just at Stash House Productions on IG for some of the great imagery that Thrawn captured. We've also uploaded a few of the riding clips, and I'm not sure where it's going to live yet, but I'm just finishing up a big photo epic with a bunch of kind of long form captions that'll be on the internet somewhere soon. So look out for that as well. I want to say a big thank you to Dometic for supporting today's episode and supporting this Crossing Tasmania project. They're one of the key supporters that made the trip happen, period, and also are helping make the film come to life as well. We relied on their CFX 395 DZ cooler for this trip, actually. The western coast of Tasmania is incredibly wild, pretty truly remote, very little amenities, not many people out there at all, and very, very few stores. And so we had to be pretty self-sufficient and self-reliant when we headed out there a couple of days before the big ride. And the powered Dometic CFX 395 cooler came in handy for our 8-person crew. We had it loaded to the gills. It kept all of our food and drinks cold for the few days before the ride, made sure we were well fed and well hydrated. And we powered this thing off of all kinds of stuff while we were out there, thanks to its flexible power source capability, from a solar panel, one of the Zamp solar panels, to their PLB lithium ion battery, and ride off the vehicle some of the time too. So love these things. Highly recommend you go check them out. You can go to dometic.com/outdoor and use code STASHE15, all caps, STACHE, 15, for 15% off your order. Thanks also to Lily McKelvin for editing and producing the show. As always, thank you, dear listeners, for being loyal listeners. Thanks for subscribing, leaving a review if you're into that sort of thing. Go check out Stash House Productions on IG if you have not yet done so. And we'll catch you next week.